Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Once again, we're moving into the summer. My guest is in Florida. I'm in Texas. So we're going to have a heat off. It's going to be a
You have the dry heat.
In Austin, it's somewhat dry. It's that kind of.
I remember people complaining about humidity in Austin and compared to Death Valley, yes.
Yeah, Florida, you win. Florida wins the humidity battle for sure.
No doubt.
So this is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We're at the Rhetorician Files again, episode 12, I think, maybe 13. I got to check. This is your 11th. This is Dave Payne's 11th.
Is it indeed?
Man, you are giving out the free wisdom.
I'm past charging tuition. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, that's the weird part, right? When the institution goes away and you come into direct contact with the consumer market. Like, how do I sell this stuff to you people? Like, the institution sells it with beer and social life, and you can't get a job without this social status.
Truly.
We got nothing, but hey, this might be useful. So
anyway, take your chances.
We are doing rhetoric here, breaking down the words, trying to force them to behave. I'm Dr. Dan, friendly neighborhood rhetorician, comedy dude. Podcast does comedians. I'm going to start doing some straight up comedy, social issue stuff. I think I'm going to call it Comedians with Issues and just do straight social issue politics comedy instead of analysis. So that should be fun. I'm still converting conservatives. Need to get back into a little bit more of that again. And we're talking to rhetoricians. This is once again, Dave Payne. We're back. And today we're going to talk about, I don't know, this conglomeration of the negative in some ways, but we're titling it failure. So we are exploring failure today because historically, Dave Payne is a clear expert on failure. Like, you've written about
downward mobility, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, you've written it. I don't know. We've all lived it at some level.
Right. And therein, I think, was one of the problems with getting my ideas across was people tended to come to the topic with a certain investment in the reality of failure and that it was personal. People would read my book and go, this is a very personal book, which for me, it absolutely was not. It was trying to deperson the whole construct of failure, but people would move into it. And I think through it with the stuff of their own failures, which is in a way what makes it rhetorically fecund, right?
Sure. Well, tell people about the book just a little bit so they have a context, because this is one of your areas of academic interest. And
right. Well, it was just...
What was the title again?
Regrettably, it was called Coping with Failure, The Therapeutic Uses of Rhetoric. And and that sort of shows, once again, where I and my audience was kind of part. I never thought of it as a therapy book. I mean, the idea was that, okay, people, I guess, cope with failure. But anyway, by that point, I gave up and said, sure, whatever.
Have people bought it for that reason, like buying it as a self-help book?
I think you pointed out to me that you checked it out of the library and saw that people take it out and then return it immediately.
No. Yeah, that happens.
Yeah, because it had that sort of label on it. But others seem to move into that rather, you know, people in rhetoric seem to move into it intuitively pretty easily.
Oh, it's a super useful concept in rhetoric. Like, and we'll talk about this today because it octopuses out into everything.
Sure, but people still kind of made their own moves on it. Like, failure is a material, real situation, and we want to know if you're kind of one kind of rhetorician. All right, what are the available responses so that it would lead to this kind of Aristotelian linear analysis? And of course, I was sort of tugging in the other direction of more of a Stoic or Zen orientation.
Let's just think about this. We don't need to do...
Why does it keep coming up? I think was for me, the reason why it was just sort of a thematic thing of... I kept noticing really at a theoretical level how many different people that talked about persuasion and sort of the indeterminacy of social situations would focus on ideas of and events of failure. So And I think there's a reason for that, which is that, if we think about just its relevance to our general topic here of persuasion, failing at something is kind of that notice. When one accepts that or has failure thrust upon them, this is sort of a premise to change. Mm-hmm. Something's gone wrong. How do you fix it? And so having noticed there is this somewhat organic relationship, then we began to manufacture failure as a premise to persuasion, right? So that, at the most basic level, look at the infomercial. The big depiction here is of what has gone wrong here and what is your responsibility for it. I recall one of the more absurd examples. The woman who did The Killing Us Softly, I can't remember her name at the moment, of the feminist commercials, gendered commercials, but showing the woman is the advertisement for snack and cakes, but her failure was she had made too big of a cake and her family was rejecting her. Oh, what a failure here. You've made too much cake, and what you really need is a smaller one. At any rate, that it is that formulaic, right? Or just kind of our basic problem solution orientation, which is ubiquitous, that you identify what the problem is, as a warrant for providing a solution. Well, the way that we personalize and also establish responsibility, it's not just something that went wrong or an error that got made. It is a failing of some sort that requires our address. So it seems to me it's kind of a process premise in persuasion to identify stuff in terms of failure. Our, any problem is potentially a failure if we make that interpretive move on it, right?
Well, so, when you think about it, like we were talking about Peaky Blinders before we came on, Dave's a fan of that, and I've jumped on the bandwagon. Like in the last episode, when he set up to assassinate Oswald, whatever that guy's name was, Oswald. Something
like that, yeah.
Yeah, some kind of callback to Lee Harvey Oswald.
He was the English fascist, right? He was
English fascist,
right?
And so his final speech, the fascist got up and was basically creating failure. It's faux failure. The reason why you've lost your money here in the Depression is because of the Jews,
right?
And that intensity of that failure, the dissonance, that dystopian space that you get caught in has to be released somehow. And politically, it becomes very useful when you've got that people in that state of failure, extended failure.
And I would think that that's kind of a requirement for any movement rhetoric, is to explain somebody's failures for them in a way that makes them not personally responsible or gives them an avenue of resolution.
Right.
This is a class disability you share here. And the way to do that is to get on board of some sort of collective action. So we all know that, all one has to do is kind of be circulating blood and have hearing to be able to see that pointing blame is the biggest game in town, right?
Yeah, for sure. In politics.
Blame is just a corollary of what failed and who's responsible, right?
Yeah, it's excavating the failure, right? Once you establish there is failure here, like people aren't happy, people don't have enough money, people yada, 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 then there has to be a cause. So it's a cause effect.
There's no bite to the analysis. Well, it's really nobody's fault. Right, That's a hard sell.
Yeah.
The explanation is too complicated and it doesn't point us in the direction of a solution, right? I guess rhetorically reminds me of the Jimmy Carter malaise speech. God, this is all complicated. Our problems, and what was the cultural answer? It was Ronald Reagan. It sort of said,
cut the Gordian knot.
Because we have failed to be true Americans and embody the spirit of World War II here.
Return to that. March forward, no matter what's there, you just go. Like we'll kill everything that at some point and just keep moving, right?
And furthermore, Reagan was very much, and not that there's anything different about today's rhetoric, but him distinctively, that this is a failure of faith. the economy will come back alive like Tinkerbell if you just believe strongly in it.
Right.
Right. And it seems to me that that's kind of been fueling that ideology ever since.
I always called that weak magic. Like when they say, like, you've got to believe in it strongly or it won't work. I'm like, well, that's terrible magic. You hear this in stories all the time. It's like, well, you have to believe in Mary Poppins or whatever in order for it to work.
It's weak technology as magic, but it's good. It's high participation, right? This is the rhetorical benefit. You're a player here. Your belief is required.
So if you look at failure, like trying to get some kind of context for this, because it is such a big concept.
Right.
So if you look at it from here's your personal life failure versus here are societal failures, or at least broad segments of society failures. I do this a lot where I just kind of break things into ladders so that my brain can hold on to it.
Sure.
So let's start here with the level of personal life, because the entire self-help movement, all of psychology, everything else starts with failure. It starts with pain. And like when you do marketing, this is one thing they say a lot in marketing. It's one of their little rhetoric or pseudo rhetoric tricks, is that you have to get people in pain or they're not going to do anything.
Sure.
So
our dissonance, discomfort somehow. Right.
Yeah. At that level of individual, what do you like? Talk about that. So.
Well, in my work, not accidentally sort of turned to self-help stuff as a rather apparent and because once again, you would go through all the rhetorical moves to identify the failure and personalize it as a way of coming up with a personal resolution. We talked about story. I noticed after tracking this for 10 or 20 years, I would go to the self-help shelf at the bookstore, and it had been kind of replaced or supplanted with how to write your own personal trauma or illness or whatever into a story, right? As a kind of a rhetorical primer. Mm-hmm. That your writing begins with seizing upon this personal loss. So once again, it's pretty formulaic that this is the. And then interestingly, Seth Rogen's got a new book out about his personal experiences. I don't know if you've seen him. He's been on radio and TV lately, hawking his book and. I thought of you because he was talking about, he said he started writing jokes and selling them at age 12 or something, but he'd formulated the idea that you don't write jokes about what you think is funny. You should write them about what bothers you. And his explanation for that was failure is more entertaining than success. Right.
So. Yeah. And that stuff definitely moved itself over into comedy. And stand up. There are so many people that consider onstage confession to be stand up comedy. And I'm like, you know, I had a guy I heckled. I didn't do it on purpose, but this guy came after me. I was just sitting in the audience one night with some other comics, and he didn't know me. And it was in LA, and he was dying on stage. So he started going after audience members, and he went after me because, you know, bald guy or whatever. He said some kind of statement. I'm like, hey, just move on. You don't want to play this. And he's like, he said something else and it was just insulting. I'm like, no, see, the game is like you insult, like you say negative things, but you turn them into comedy. If you don't turn them into comedy, it's just an insult. And then I get up and kick your ass. And he's like, because that confession stuff and all the therapeutic stuff makes it over into comedy, but the stand-up, all the mechanics and dictates of stand-up end up shrinking. So it's like, it's not funny, dude. Like you can say whatever you want.
Well, there is the scapegoating branch of comedy, right? Of making fun of others and their disabilities.
Yeah, but it's got to be funny. Like, right. Otherwise, it's just an insult.
Right.
You know, you have to use the techniques of comedy in your confession or anything else. And there's tons of comics who do it and do it really well. Yeah. But.
Well, I used to think about it as a matter of framing. I mean, what's it like to be the coyote in the Roadrunner and Coyote cartoon? Right. I mean, talk about failure.
Yeah.
So I think it is this sort of vehicle to the personal and yes, confessional genres and right. You're right. I've seen a lot of it in comedy lately, but before that, you know, the Jerry Springer and Oprah of people You know, there's a sort of bonding of identification at that level of confessing.
Absolutely. You know, yeah.
That seems to supersede, you know, this is a beginning of a kind of social healing and acceptance to go ahead and say, you know, here's what I did. So, or here's what happened to me. And so it tends to dissolve a lot of other kinds of issues into this moment of identification. So I think it has that resource. And that's the only reason, you know, that you're not in a tragic mode with the Roadrunner and Coyote, because your identification is with the Roadrunner. You're not thinking about what it's like to be the Coyote.
Yeah, and he's
or the person failure, who slips on the banana peel or whatever.
But there's also the range of failure, right? Over here is complete terminal failure. You're dead. You're gone. It's done. And it's hard to keep that in the comic frame. But as long as it comes up to that and then goes back, I mean, he just plays the same game again and dies in horrible ways, but you never see the death.
Right.
Like
right,
Kenny from South Park. He dies every episode, sure, but he's sure. back.
Yeah, and we really don't want to see, you know, the death of the coyote, right? The death of Ivan Illich. We don't really want to visit that tragic. Well, anyway, so I think but rhetorically that personal is kind of the proof of the embodiment of the social as well. And I think what we tend to do is hook those things up. But it's interesting that this is kind of an egg that you can open either end of. And for the last 30 years or so, we seem to be working a lot from the self end of things. That is the personal failing. And either as a vehicle for repair, a vehicle for identification, a vehicle for exposition, or finding one's own authenticity, or, you know, or we talked about Est, which I think was kind of an interesting right. moment in, because you could sort of do, it's sort of like Christianity on crack, you could do unlimited amount of personal transformation if you continue to make your errors, but then you recognize them and have a vocabulary for them and come back. Yeah. And so Werner Arhard himself had like 7 different names or identities, from a used car salesman to something else. So that doctrine of personal transformation, well, once again, accepting failure, because that imports you in a way, right? Once again, if there is no failure, you aren't really influencing anything. So in a culture of success, failure is necessary. And in most success narratives, you're going to see a kind of a history of failure that sort of paved the way for or made the success possible or meaningful in some sort of fashion. So.
Yeah, it becomes this really dominant binary, this failure success, because it is it's a defining system and people internalize it. Like when you look at, I've done this work where I've broken this apart into, well, what are the areas of failure in life? Like you have relationship failure, you have health failure where you can't control your health, you have material failure, you know, all these different types of failure. And essentially you got a pile of things over here that you're not doing well in, and either you're doing really well over here so you can amplify and make this light bright enough where you don't look at that darkness, or people are always going back over here and trying to do more work to fix the failure, but they get caught in this binary split, and it's endless. If you use that, it's an endless challenge, loss, success, you know.
Sure. Well, as an illustration pops into my head is something that I return to any number of times in my own life, which is having the threesome of a career, a relationship, and children, parenting, suggesting that it's almost impossible to be good at any more than 2 of those, right? So this guarantees failure in 1 of the 3, right? That's maybe more likely you can only really succeed at 1 of them, but I don't know. I think we have to have a containment strategy of some sort for failure, because if you, the person who accepts that their entire life is wiped out is, of course, then that's you need therapeutic moment, right? You know, yesterday was it the governor of California saying, what the hell does this shooting say about where we are in America? And one wonders, you know, where are these people that decide that my last act here needs to be to kill other people and then off myself? I mean, this is the therapeutic system's gone completely awry. I mean, this is uncontained failure somehow, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting.
So we don't want that. There has to be a way to compartmentalize and transform, and failure must itself come with a kit of repairs.
So, yeah, I think that's part of the problem with the American story, right? The activated American, that you don't just accept failure. Like, instead of suicide, you go to homicide, and not one homicide, multiple homicides. So it's a big enough splashy homicide that you have at least achieved that, you know, and I think that becomes a lot of that rhetoric for, you know, that particular mindset, that's a spectacular success.
I guess, in a sense that at least people understood finally how much I lost or something. It's pretty desperate stuff.
Yeah,
I think once again that what's gone wrong there is, I'm not saying there's any easy answers to either the psychological or the social end of this. I'm just saying that to the extent that failure sort of is a prelude to social repairs, and the rhetoric of failure would be that these tend to be people that those repairs are not happening for somehow.
Right. So it's not happening on the individual level for them.
The rhetoric isn't working.
Right. And for us societally, like, they keep happening, so we can never repair this. It's just constantly ripped again and again and again. And there never is any type of catharsis to it or, you know, salvation to it.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned that sort of the binary of success and failure. And not surprisingly, I've encountered a bazillion quotations offsetting the ironic duality of that, and most recently a Stoic principle that which I guess kind of captures my posture as much as anything, which is accept success without arrogance and failure with indifference. And I guess my adding to that would be suspicious of both, right?
Well, I think that's a really good statement about what rhetorician, where you end up as a rhetorician, right? You end up suspicious.
Well, I guess that's my recommendation, right?
Yeah. You end up suspicious of all of it, and you end up mitigating like the successes. You're like, there's just a bunch of factors that brought this together. It's not like I'm, you know, the Ubermensch that just made this happen. And you also look at failure, like, you can try to slam me for this failure, but there are all these things that created this failure, and I can see them. So I'm not going to take on that.
Meeting it with indifference strikes me as because of the difference. The investing in the difference gets you into one of these sequences. And I think from my own analytic point of view, I thought about the word success as simply succession, right? And we've talked about, you know, narrative. Failure is a disruption in some sort of succession, right? All success means is that one thing followed another thing without, right? Without failure, some sort of falter, rift occurring, or disruption.
Yeah. Have you watched the TV show Alone?
No.
So they drop, I don't know, 10 or 15 people into these remote areas in Canada that are basically unlivable, and they're supposed to, and whoever stays the longest wins.
Well, I've seen some version of this anyway.
Yeah, there's a bunch of survival shows, but this one's pretty unique because they're completely alone, and it's a competition, which means instant success and failure. You know, the other ones like Survivor Man and things like that, they drop him out there, but he's got the skills, you know, he's going to live. Sometimes he has to bail out and call for help, but he doesn't lose anything really when that happens. These people have, I think, $100,000 or maybe at least $100,000, but only one of them gets it. Everybody else loses. And so there are people on there that go into extreme emaciation and starve themselves because they've locked in this idea of success and failure so strongly. And this is, they record themselves all the time in diaries talking about why they're still staying here or why they want to leave. And you can just feel the seething sense of, oh my God, the failure I will experience if I have to go back to the world. And then the success I will achieve. And they talk about changing everybody's life with the money. It's not even enough money to do that, but it's just a great illustration. Yeah, of success.
Yeah, I have tuned into Naked and Afraid, which is a slightly less extreme version, I guess. And there's no money involved as far as I know, but the transformative power of making it and not giving up. Right. So anytime you see people striving to do something, failure is lurking in the wings there, right? To blot that out. And so, you know, and the whole competitive thing culture-wide, you know, in terms of codifying different forms of success and failure, the whole voting people off the island competition, I forget, whatever, what was that called? Were they?
Survivor, yeah.
Was that Survivor? Yeah. But I, you know, and then The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, you know, and then even down to, you know, teenagers or 10-year-olds cooking competitions. We tend to have seeded that into everything. Some of this, I guess the Iron Chef thing kind of started a lot of the cooking competition stuff. But sort of encoding what seems to be a Japanese ethic of, you know, kind of like the Pokemon, that this competition breeds a kind of a healthy improvement of some sort. And we seem to be rife with this stuff, right? And I think what must come along with that is the ease of repair. I think, right, once again, we don't want people falling off the success.
I don't know, man. Like there seems to be more failure acceptance now, like all the way to the edge, and they don't ever really get redeemed. They don't get a chance to come back. And a lot of our narratives are just pushing it further and further and further. Even Peaky Blinders, those anti-heroes, I mean, they did plenty to deserve to die. They were usually killing bad people, but
once
always.
Again, there's kind of an episodic reset button. Right. I think once again, this is kind of the ethic of, you're right. There is no redemption. There is no repair. The sequence doesn't end in transformation, but you can't just hit the reset button. It's kind of like the video game construct, right? Where you die at age level 4.
Right. You just start over
until you get better at it. So
I think the
failure is kind of detoothed, I think, in a lot of these things. And I think, once again, separating out the shame elements and the guilt elements, you know, the responsibility there, making it too easy to sort of hit the reset button is another kind of cultural norm, but maybe one that is functional for us at this point in time. Because once again, the absolute ubiquity of possible of things to fail at. The sheer amount of judgmentalness that's going on. How can anybody even arrive at adulthood without some pretty successful coping equipment? So maybe the book is correctly titled if we understand coping properly.
That's a good question. Like, we have totally accepted, internalized the structure of failure into so many things in American culture. Be interesting to see how other cultures work within that failure matrix. You know, how much of it do they allow in? But in our culture, I don't know if it's because of capitalism or because of, you know, some of the base American democracy stuff. But
capitalism seems to at least as a practice in America, increase your range of choices. And if you increase the range of choices or endeavors that one might, you invent not only new possibilities for failure, but also kind of a second order set of failures, failure to choose, not knowing how to choose, right? And then, I think it ups the ante considerably.
But it's interesting, the Amazon, the phenomenon of Amazon, you know, buying things online now, there's a new failure in there because Zeke and I got on there once and he made smoothies all the time. So he needed some ice trays and we had some bad ice trays that were too hard to get ice out of. So I'm like, well, let's just get online and get some more. And so we got on there and there's 9 million choices. And we ended up buying these ones that looked pretty cool. And they showed up and they were about this big, you know, the tray. Like, I'm like, now you have to look at the dimensions of everything. You know, there's so many ways to fail in that purchase. And I'm like, it's cool. It does everything we want, but it's so tiny, it's useless. And so all these new forms of failure that capitalism keeps spinning up, you know, like the online purchase, or like we're doing a marketing project right now for a client, and we have to spin up all their social aspects and their Facebook and Google Places and all these things. And it's just rife with click failure. You hit something, it's supposed to work, doesn't work.
Sure.
So now you got to figure out your failure. It's endless.
Right. And once again, if we don't develop, you know, if we're properly socialized, it's the ones that are become salient to, you know, existential circumstances that should penetrate the armor. And if that's not true of you, then that's pathological, right? But I do think we tend to up the game, and there is a considerable amount of film drama devoted to that. I think I mentioned in one of our other podcasts, I'd studied adolescent movies, and the sense of shame and frustration and existential block that got expressed in all these teen angst movies. Sure, all I have to do is, you know, find somebody to love me and live happily ever after and the perfect job. That there's a lot of, you know, the Graduate is kind of like, I think, a hallmark in that that genre of just numbness at the prospects of plastics or adulthood or, you know, whatever it may be. So I think once again that the possibilities for success in our society breed many more opportunities for failure. And that the kinds of success dangled in front of us. Once again, we look at these incels that are, you know, enacting violence and stuff, and wondering, you know, what's become of us. But what are the avenues? You know, what are the repairs? What are the people reaching out to embrace and smooth over those? You know, as somebody, a young person confronts the enormous responsibility of success in this culture.
Yeah,
so I'm venturing out of my field into psychology, but I see the data for it in the social drama all of the time.
I think the percentage of success, like success, is easily like dismissed, right? It's easily dismissed. Failure, man, that's tar. That is hard to get off of you.
That was William James' line in The Varieties of Religious Experience, where he's saying, how did people get into this religious second lives, right? Basically, what he called the lives of the twice born, the religious convert. And that was his line. With what a damning emphasis, does failure blot us out?
Right? Yeah, right?
There's no parallel between success and failure.
Your failure has been so endemic, so unavoidable, that you have to go away and come back anew.
Right. And we talked about, you know, sort of the pervasiveness of in our own personal orientation, that we have this sort of modern responsibility to craft the successful identity. Well, failure blots out an identity. And I guess that's, once again, what part of what led me down these paths was all the different ways the work of Irving Goffman as a sociologist is really a compendium on the social consequences of failure, looking at sites and situations, what he called failure graveyards, that somehow society was sorting us into different groupings as a result of our failings, right? So we would look at mental institutions, he would look at, you know,
failure graveyards. What a great term that is.
Yeah.
How are you going to forget that one? Oh, man.
I couldn't.
Graveyard.
Especially in graduate school.
Which?
What is that thing? What is that thing that led me here? Right.
I'm curious. What is the graduation rate once people enter grad departments? Like, is it a failure graveyard? Is it 50-50? Is it?
Well, you know, that's what they said when I started, which was 40 years ago or so, right, at least, that the number of people who finished was about 50-50. I would say the success rate is much higher.
Yeah, the institution's vested in getting people through it.
Well, and as somebody who conferred those degrees and dealt with those decisions for all my career, what I've noticed that I've been intrigued by the way that faculty, you really don't want failure. I mean, they'll go a long way out of their way to it's very difficult decision to send somebody packing. So
yeah, it is. It's one of the things, again, I like about stand-up is that there's an impartial
off stage, right? The hook comes out and
there's an impartial jury, you know, and they are merciless and their judgment is immediate.
Yeah. I mean, look at the language. You either kill or you die, right?
Yeah. Well, there's nothing.
There's no shade of gray, really.
There's nothing more definitive. Right? There's nothing more definitive in failure than telling a joke and hearing nothing. It's a definitive judgment.
Well, I like Dimitri Martin, who looks at all of these. If you tag it with the phrase "sort of" afterward, so that was a good set. Sort of. I love you. Sort of, right?
Sort of.
Yeah. You're going to live, sort of.
Yeah, comedy's interesting for failure because it's once you do professional stand-up for so long, there's really no sweet spot. Like if the audience laughs too easily, you don't respect them. You're like, I was just an easy audience. They don't laugh enough, then you don't respect them because they're stupid and they didn't get it. There's no sweet spot at a certain level. You're never happy. It never feels like success.
Sounds like a coping strategy, right?
Yeah. And stand-up is built in failure because even every level you ascend and you get the skills and the experience to do well, you have to keep moving up in order to, you know, survive. It's like a shark. You got to keep moving. So like you see guys at the very, very top who are like, I'm at the top, but now how do I stay here? And Seinfeld tries to move, you know, goes up through, did well in stand-up, went up through sitcoms, and then tried to move over to movies because they just keep finding new worlds until they get enough failure. Like, I don't need any of that. I'll go back to where my success graveyard.
Well, there you go. There's Tom Robbins. Success eliminates just as many options as failure. Indeed, right. He continues, it's not clear the success is an adequate response to life.
So
the one thing I started noticing was just all the, you know, all the literature of failure. And if you think about drama, and we talked about, you know, the absolute saturation of story forms, Seth Rogen's right. Failure is more interesting. It is the MacGuffin. It is the
intrusion, failure.
That's right. I meant to disarm it, but I couldn't.
Only a small failure. Our bar is low so that we don't failure.
There you go.
In here. We only let failure at the very,
We have to increase the drama somehow. So if you think about how is failure coded, you know, into these enactments, you know, the sitcom structure of failing when the, you know, before the first commercial with the repair, before the last commercial, classical drama, tragedy, and comedy is also, it's not about failure. It's really about just a different treatment, right? It's about embarrassment rather than, you know, inability in the end. So the comedy and tragedy are really both addressed to the foibles and the failures of human beings, just two different orientations toward it. So look at education. I mean, look at the complex encoding, you know, when we think about how much the Goffman idea about how society sorts you according, you know, you're taking achievement tests in the third grade, at least I did, that begin to track you with other people sociologically throughout your life. An education level, you know, So there is a sense in which the PhD is itself one of these sortings.
And the institutions, you know, the institutionality of failure, right? Every institution erects its own failure and success structures.
Sure.
And sometimes they're completely at odds with the institution next door and your regular life in the world and your own personal values. But the structures are so strong in every one of those institutions.
And business, I think that the morphology of failure in business is in a way one of the most intriguing because it seems to be the place where we've done more experimental work. I think about, you know, Death of a Salesman, Willie Loman. It used to be enough that having a good personality was enough, right?
Yeah.
But there's no doubt that that's what Arthur Miller was up to. In fact, when they interviewed him about the meaning of salesman, he said, well, the theme there is that failure equals death in American culture. And that's, of course, that's also echoed by the sociologist Goffman, that in failure, you die one of the deaths that's possible for you. And you have to either find another track of identity and make those repairs and move, or you'd fail to. So,
in salesman, like you saw Biff, you know, who found his way out of failure by saying, I am a failure at business. I don't care about it. I'm going to go work outside. You know, right. The naturalist, and just that's going to be my area of success. And then, you know, his dad just wouldn't let him out. It's like, you can't go.
Well, yeah, you were talking about the cross-cultural differences in failure. And I recall hearing Arthur Miller speak when he got back from China. They had, as part of the cultural exchange program in the early 80s, produced Death of a Salesman in China. And he came back and he wrote about it, but he also came to my university and spoke. And I thought it was kind of fascinating because it is such a master text of American failure. And he said, well, you know, one of the first problems was that they had no traveling salesmen in China, so it was pretty hard to find the cognates. But that what outraged the Chinese about it was the way that the sons were treating the father.
That tradition of never calling the father out for failure, no matter what, like you've seen that in that's a very strong story strand that you see too, where the father's clearly a failure. The Western has a lot of that in it.
Well, I happen to think in the West, father as failure is a pretty strong trope. If you think about all the sitcoms that were all about.
Oh yeah.
Dad's a complete screw up.
Incompetent dad. Yeah. Or as they call in Hollywood, fat husband, hot wife. Yeah, but like, I guess cross-culturally, like you think about that, like the taboo of pointing out parental failure or ancestral failure and that kind of stuff is pretty strong.
I would think so. I would think so. That you know, it's back to honor sort of a, you know, maybe there's just kind of a keeping the record, or maybe they understand that at some other level, this kind of, you know, treat failure with indifference, that maybe this is not, this final judgment about these people is inherently unfair.
Well, America can't handle that programmatic failure across generations that's just built into your blood or your lineage, because then capitalism sort of breaks down. You can never get away from it. You know, capitalism needs that sort of fragmentation so they can constantly throw more failure into your life and more possible successes lure into your life. If you're a programmatic failure, I mean, what are they going to lure you with?
Yeah, well, there's the other thing going on in American culture. I guess what William Baer called the illusion of technique, that everything that goes wrong will be met with some sort of technique of repair. So we, you know, as much as we have all these institutional encodings of failure, we also have all these institutional programs of repair, right? So we have a pretty active diagnostic culture. I noticed this when my kids were going to school, no matter what the problem was, it was always a problem of self-esteem. And this is the one diagnosis we can treat, because we have a psychologist who will, you know, build self-esteem.
Right.
And I suppose there is a kind of a bottom line there. So you know, whatever the cause of the failure is, you're going to feel bad about yourself. So this is where we begin the repair.
Well, it's a very iffy diagnosis and prescription bond. And I see this a lot in alternative health. Like somebody will be low on iron, and so the prescription is give them more iron, you know, give
right,
them more iron.
There you go.
That'll fix it. It's like, well, why are they low in iron? I don't know, but just give them more iron. They're low on self-esteem. What do? You give them more esteem.
But we don't correct the failure mechanism of attributing failure, nor do we try to figure out ways of creating more success. Although I think maybe in some ways there, you know, my student of the month is one of those ways of creating possibilities for success. But
really it's just dumping
really
esteem.
Dispersing them throughout the population is
it's an esteem dump, right? It's just, hey, just dump more esteem on them. But we're tearing it down over here in so many ways, programmatically in the culture. No, don't worry about that. Just keep dumping more esteem on them. And you've understood this as a parent. Like, there's nothing more painful than seeing your kid fail at something, and you just want to avoid it in any way you can. So, absolutely. You know, you don't want to give them false esteem, because then that ruins them too. So the esteem game as a parent's a real challenge.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. And once again, as you shepherd these people through their lives, the opportunities for failure in the school system are horrendous, right?
And the social system.
And I think maybe that's different than my father's generation in the one room schoolhouse, to where, you know, shit didn't go too well. They just went hunting.
Right.
So they found other things they could do, and they didn't seem to be tortured for their entire lives as a result.
Well, and as I used to say, the requirements for success change further and further we go deeper into modernity. Like, my dad could fix the TV by hitting it on the top of it with the palm of his hand. I'm like, well, I could do that. You know, I can't reprogram the interface, you know, right, to get it to Hulu to come up.
Try that with your laptop, right?
So, okay. So there's the individual at that level of the ladder. And then down here, we have collective failure, societal failures, human failure, American failure. So what's the difference there as we move there? Are we importing just the same structures? Because in politics, you now see it's all the politics of failure, applying failure to the other side, slander, attack, demean, all these things. And it just becomes this massive grid of failure. And I think especially on the right, like, that's their main technique, is to haul things up and just keep throwing shit at you until something sticks. But it's all failure that they're throwing, in some form or another, crime or sin or lacking or weakness.
We have failed. We have failed to do X, Y, or Z as a group, right?
Yeah. So big collective failure versus that individual failure in a person.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about how one of the rhetorical reflexes is to explain somebody's personal failure for them in terms of these group, you know, and that the ideology of any movement is going to be in a way a design. The Marxist is going to explain your lack of mobility, your lack of whatever, for you in a way that depersonalizes you. Here's what you were up against, and here's your solution, is by correcting your thoughts and your understanding and joining in the collective movement here. So I think the ideology, the political reflex, you know, of any sort does that. What's wrong? Why are you living in the middle of Indiana, working a dead end job and haven't had a raise in 10 years? And you know, nobody's built a new swimming pool, and the factory's empty, and, you know.
Yeah, the Bruce Springsteen songs.
Yeah, well, you not only have a Bruce Springsteen song, but you also have, a group of people who voted for Trump. Okay. Because there was a message there about what was wrong, what went wrong for you, okay? And once you start sorting out these various claims, that is kind of the nougat that holds these different attitudes about immigration, attitudes about liberals, attitude about cities, attitude, you know, on and on and on and on. And certainly race competition in the economy is one of those.
Well, no, those are the power cells of fascism, right? That's why, because it is a failure-based rhetoric that I'm going to tell you where the failure came from. You just haven't seen it.
Well, as you were pointing out in Peaky Blinders, the fascist was very good of course, you know, in the Great Depression, people need to know what went wrong.
A lot of failure going on in the Great Depression.
A lot of failure going on. And so people tend, you know, they tend to seek total solutions and simple explanations for those social categorical failures and what that spells for them. So it's not just an intellectual exercise. It is the people whose lives have, you know, moved downward in some way from their expectations who are rife for those explanations. Now, I do think there are these kind of ones that seem to float out there more abstractly, the things to be afraid of, right? And I think that's, you know, what should you fear and who's to blame are kind of those seem to be pretty abstract things in a lot of political talk. They don't seem to make those same steps down to how does this impact you personally? So I do think there's a lot of just sort of free-floating anxiety created by that. And so that's
don't you think that was kind of Biden's turn, like in some of the debates where he would turn to the camera and be like, here's what I want to know. Think about your life right now. Are you better off? Are you happier? There, like taking that big political abstraction and trying to drive it down into people's personal lives.
Sure. Whereas, you know, the Trumpian, what's wrong, what's to blame kinds of answers, they do seem to be kind of out there. But I think once again, those paths to connect to those things are there. It's kind of like the prisoner's jokes. They've told them so often, they don't have to actually tell the joke. They just shout out the number, right?
Right.
And so I think those kinds of easy topoi in rhetorician's term, those common topics, or tropes, are just sort of so familiar. That's why I guess what we call them dog whistles.
Well, one of the rhetorical tricks I saw on the terminological level was, I talked about this a few years ago, the replacement of the old terms, all the racist terms, all the, you know, ethnic terms, all those things with the word liberal. Like, it's literally an epithet. It's literally a racist word for that.
Oh, absolutely.
Socialist, all that stuff. But they found safety in the exact same rhetoric. It's a bait and switch. Like in jokes, the semantic structure of a bait and switch is everything's exactly the same until the last word, which causes this crazy mental, emotional explosion if you do it correctly. Like my buddy wrote a joke once. There's a gay stoner movie out. It's called Dude, Where's My Dude? And if you know all the, you know, dude, where's my car? And you've been in there, everything's, you're predicting it all the way until that last word shifts. And moving the word liberal, and now they're moving the word socialist and Democrat over into there, keeping all the everything else the same. I mean, it literally is fascist rhetoric, just with safer terms, it seems
like. Sure. Well, you know, these are kind of summarizing big clumps of experience, but there's actual work going on. I mean, you can look at that movement in Newt Gingrich's 1984 pamphlet that's saying, do you want to give speeches like Newt? Well, here, use positive words. Here's use contrasting words. And then there's a list. And basically, this was rhetorical training for how to sort of glom onto your opponent all of these negative terms that, and I hear the echo of that pamphlet actually even in today's right-wing rhetoric. Some Rifa called people anti-child. Well, that's on that list. Call them anti-child, anti-American, and it all, and liberal does become a code word for the whole bundle. And that was a successful renaming campaign. For that group of people, the word liberal evokes all of that, anti-flag, anti-child, anti-America, anti-tradition.
Which are all moral failures, right? All
absolutely.
Moral and cultural and societal failures that they can now label, you know, dump onto somebody and be like, ergo, the action warrant here is not only to vote them out of office, but we've got to do something about them. You know, just
standing in line yesterday at the art museum, and the issue was whether you had to wear a mask or not, because in some places now you can go without one. And the man behind me, when the guy said you had to wear a mask, it's like a blue state governor. Wait a minute, you're in Florida. What are you talking about? His vocabulary of blame and attribution was readily at hand. Blue state. So all of this simply becomes code, right? Or in the, you know, rhetoricians laying God terms and devil terms. They sum up all of those. But if you want to see the original list, you can always, you know, look it up. There's, you know, the clusters of terms that you're right. And right at base, there is a moral charge. you're right, this is all the language of morality, because it contains that, not only the hermeneutics of evil, if you will, but the implicit who's to blame and what's the repair. How should you regard it? And you don't want to be part of that, right?
Well, and I see it on both sides. This is one of the reasons why the far left, and I think millennials, my daughter, and the people that I've talked from that side that are usually activated within a cause, end up getting accused of the same thing, because they've got such moral failure terms. And it's so intense for them when somebody, you know, uses terms that bring them over into villainy. And it's just so trigger. It's just a trigger happy, triggerable environment that you're like, hey, let's not get caught here on the same thing that the right is doing, which is just terminological level thinking. You know, just stay with the term. I'm like, let's go into this a little bit. And I had an activist on here a couple weeks ago, and we talked about this. Like, and I realized after the episode, I had made the title, it's LGBTQ plus is part of the title. And I had written LGB or LBGTQ. And she didn't notice it. I didn't notice it, but it's a complete inversion of the suggested term. And I'm like, oh, I failed at that. And I told her during the thing, I'm like, I'm going to fail. There's too many terminological landmines here that I'm not practiced with. So we've got to give me space to fail without the whole judgment cascade going down, or we can't communicate, because I will get frozen. And so it's that same sense of failure always looming. Like, there's always, when I talk to my daughter, there's always failure looming, and I have to pull her out of that. I'm like, we can't do that, you know?
Well, you know, and that was Obama's sort of message to the woke generation of just making these judgments is not sufficient, right? That's not political action. You may feel better about, you know, the way you've organized the world as a result of being able to. It's a point I've made in criticism class too. It's just writing parking tickets for offending, you know, for not, you know, being part of the PC ideal is not, you know, the end of this process. So I do think that moral judgmentalness is. But you use the word trigger happy environments, and maybe that's where we need to focus. Well, it isn't that we. There's nothing particularly new about having these kinds of judgments. I mean, there have been conflicts all along. If you were to travel in time back to the abolition movement, you would see a lot of this going on.
Sure.
Of course, it did lead to all-out civil war, but.
Well, that
so we can't say it was completely innocuous.
Well, that's what I was saying. Failure, the prescription for failure, for fixing failure, because failure moves over into villainy and evil. And then, you know, you go down the list of, oh, what do we have to do to fix this? And you finally get down, we have to kill these people because they're just endemic failures and villains. And
right. Well, there is also the component of why do we want to, and you know, what's the payoff for engaging in that kind of dramatic good evil and taking things to the end of the line where everything becomes emblematic of these bigger struggles, and part of it is because in those vocabularies your suffering has meaning, you know, I think Eliade's line about religion is we are able to tolerate it morally because it's not absurd. So there's a lot of control and empowerment to be able to sling those vocabularies and name the sources of your anxieties and miseries, because it makes it tolerable to live in those worlds of loss and suffering. Is that really the best that we as right-thinking moderns can come up with? What's gone wrong here? You know, what makes the environment trigger happy in a literal kind of way is that somehow the resources of repair, the resources of cooperation, of transcendence of those conflicts maybe do not seem to be working as well as they should. That there should be, you know, just to take the more narrow domain of politics, we don't seem to be able to put that in a certain kind of level or kind of conflict or, you know, difference of opinion and interpretation and move on with other things. There's the transcendence seems to be more difficult. So there is a kind of a, you know, once again, I like the phrase trigger happy, that we want to pull the trigger on it. Rather than let it pass and move to some other, get on board with some other kind of cooperative.
Right. So you're kind of running two games here. You're running for human beings. They're going to get caught in these tar pits of failure, and you're going to want to help them out.
I like it, tar pits of failure. Yes.
You're going to want to have mechanisms in place so that they can continue to live and not fall into deep despondency and existential cynicism and all this kind of stuff. But politically, you can't get away from those tar pits. You need those. You need to shove people into those tar pits, and you need to promise that you can get them out of those tar pits.
Keep teetering on the edge of the tar pit who's holding the rope? Yes. Was that your joke of why is quicksand work so slowly?
I don't think, was that my joke?
I came across it recently.
Oh yeah, maybe it was, yeah.
I think maybe that was your joke.
Poorly named things. Quicksand.
Why is quicksand, you know, drawing these people down in it so slowly?
Yeah, that's one of my personal entertainments in life, is just to look at the language and find the little things of humor that nobody else has pulled out.
Absolutely.
Yet. They're all over the place.
You know, I like the description very much. That once again, it is a, and I think for us, right, that ups the game for us at the personal level. With, you know, if you think about back to your question about the social constructions of failure, my God, compared to any, you know, and no wonder our children are so burdened. I mean, climate change, you know, you are responsible. And what can you do? Well, I can carry my Coke cans out to the curb every Tuesday. Beyond that, it's hard to feel comfortable when they, you know, you read other things about 5 years we're going to be out of water or, you know, whatever. So I think that general free, you know, and I think this generation, a generation, you know, in all fairness, in many ways, raised by educated liberals in classrooms, where we dump that on them, all of the possibilities of bad outcomes, you know, and we ask why there's a problem with anxiety and esteem. So there are these sort of looming possibilities of really, you know, because that, and that is maybe an overactive persuasive agenda of social reform that also constructs failure and responsibility. So, you know, that it shouldn't be too surprising there's a bit of kickback against that. Because if you pressure cook people that way and then give them no avenues of repair, as a possibility, just spitballing here. But I think we want to take stock of that, those discourses. And as we've observed, in terms of ultimates, people who engage in the language of ultimates, the apocalyptic rhetoric.
That's
being prepared for it in a way.
So. Yeah, the ultimate failure, like your failure is going to be called to task here in the apocalypse, and you are going to be judged, and it's going to happen, and you need to be ready because you are failing badly. I like that term, pressure cook people with all this failure and then give them no avenues of repair, because I think that does sum up a lot of the modern experience of. Like I had this, whenever you write anything controversial as a joke, people's big indictment of you, their big heckle online is, oh, you know, you think you're funny, or that's not funny, or I thought you were supposed to be a comedian. So they go after your failure, you know, your existential failure as a comic. And I'm always like, well, I'm not sure you're the quality judge that I need in order to pull this, you know, this evaluation off. But it's this sense of going after the thing that's most important to you, right? The thing of your identity that they can hurt you with the most, they think. But for me, like, hey, I've gotten paid $300,000 a year for writing jokes about the news. You cannot break my self-esteem about me as a joke writer. You can attack a joke, but you can attack me. Like I've been vetted by guys who I know are super funny, and they hired me and kept me around. So there's a certain level of proof that got me to a level of self-esteem on one thing in life, which is joke writing, a particular type of jokes sometimes too. But you see people go after that anytime you have some type of internal success, stasis, it disrupts them. It's like, that's not acceptable or normal. We can't leave that in place, and they want to go after it. But I think it is that sense of we've all had so much failure baked into us. It is our terminology of life.
And we have baked into us as well certain kinds of repair sequences, but maybe they're not always working as well as they should. But that back to sort of the template of rhetoric being religious conversion. We've got 5,000 years to work out how to change people from one thing into another thing. You know, they got a pretty good software program. And once again, who's up to distributing failure except, right, religion? You know, think about the concept of original sin. You sort of start off and
what a great rhetorical move that was. Hey, you're not getting
brilliant.
Away from
absolutely
this.
Brilliant.
There's no escape, even for babies.
But all of that puts you on a slippery slope of persuadability, which is where they want you. And but that, once again, that comes with a whole kit of repairs, right? And it's kind of like the ominousness of climate change and the patheticness of recycling. The ominousness of original sin, but okay, say four Hail Marys, you know, that'll get you through the week, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Always stay in the deficit.
Programmatic, abstract, massive, seething failure. Hey, just take this little bead, just count it like four times and say that prayer, and you'll be all right.
So, a lot of the failure stuff does arc us back or tie us back to the religious constructs, and Christianity has been called the religion of fallen man. This is not incidental, but back to the point of not only is the script of failure and its inevitability pretty much guaranteed in this worldview, but also the sequences are scripts of repair, how to get back into the graces, apology and contrition and right, redemption and all of those kinds of things.
Or if you're in politics, it's not that soft path back to redemption. It's the fiery path. You know, it's the wage war against those who caused the failure, and that's going to redeem you.
Sure. Well, you know, I think there's a way that this was kind of supposed to work in terms of our primary socialization, which was that you get that little moment of redemption in the voting booth, and then you go back to your business. But back to the Hitler program that we cited a week or so ago, never let him cool off seems to be more the totalitarian program, because you have to have a constant demonstrative need, because it isn't that the totalitarian point of view is, you know, without failure. No, I think it is strident in distributing failure, but it all points in one direction. The totalizing effect of there's one solution that will take care of it for you. And I think that's all failures, all frustrations have to be dissolved into one primary cause for which there's one primary answer. Me, the leader.
Right.
So there is that totalitarian aspect to it. Yeah.
I will save you from all the forces that are wanting you to fail. Again, go back to Peaky Blinders and look at the main character, Thomas Shelby, and how he's always dragging basically failure toward him by trying to constantly move up through class.
That's true.
And so all these things, he keeps every season is a new set of enemies because he's moved up in a new class. And they're killing off his family and they're attacking, you know, that. He's like, no, I will protect you. I'll get enough power in here. And this last one is like basically trying to move up to be the prime minister. And once I get enough power, you know, then I will be able to save everyone from all the failure elements coming after them.
Well, we talked about narrative structures and contemporary culture and contemporary heroes. And we talked about Breaking Bad. And so you went to see Peaky Blinders. I went to see to review Breaking Bad. But there's also a story structure there that's relevant to contemporary society. I'd say The Sopranos, which I think is sort of the master text of American culture in the last 20 years. And Breaking Bad's, you know, right in there.
Yeah.
But Peaky Blinders also has the same sort of narrative structure, which is kind of a protracted Roadrunner and Coyote. No matter what they do, it's episodic. It gets undone. There is a slippery slope of trying to succeed that continually goes awry. The plans are always undermined. Whatever they're trying to fix, there is no moment of success, really. Right? Success is instantly the opportunity for the next level or degree. And once again, it is maybe kind of like that same video game frustration that you can't get good enough to win. You will either die or the world will be ended or whatever, regardless. And so what is that a recipe for? I think, you know, there's some opportunities to investigate that kind of perpetual, you know, failing. And that these are our heroes in that they continue, their resourcefulness, their effort, their ambitions continues to redress this in each and every stage. So what does that tell us that is the game, you know, that is the path of success, is just sort of staying even as best you can till the next, you know, horrendousness and complication and villainy ups the game. So I wonder if, you know, is that what it's like climbing the corporate ladder these days? I tend to suspect it is.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right.
It is kind of the Peter principle experienced at a personal level. You will continue to win until you find that level at which you no longer win, and then you're going to stall out.
Well, and Thomas Shelby says it in Peaky Blinders, like, they're asking him, when are you going to stop? And he's like, when I find a man I can't defeat.
Mm.
And it's that sense of defeat, total failure, like that would stop him. Like total success doesn't seem like it ever stopped him. It didn't really ever stop, you know, Walter White and Breaking Bad. There's so much failure in there that he was, you know, moving away from, and he found something to be successful for. And that scene of his ultimate success when she takes him to the storage unit and shows him the stack of money.
Right.
That's the American victory, right? It's this big cube of unspendable amount of money. And she's like, what are you going to do now? And that's when he finally is like, okay, I can move away from this. And, you know, at that point, everything falls apart around him and he ends up in a...
Yeah, he's kind of consumed there into the degeneration of all against all there somehow.
But everything he did win the American story all the way
through. He loses all that money.
Yeah. Created a business, got the money, limited...
But you're right. And I was tracking that through the various seasons when his motivable vocabulary shifts from, I'm doing this to, you know, secure my family and yada, yada, yada. And that's a constant little marker that you see move directly in the dialogue. In fact, you know, around Jesse says to him, okay, you originally started, you only wanted $737,000. That's what you figured to get your kids through college. Why not quit? And that's when his own language begins to turn into, this is the one thing I'm good at. And he introduces his own little failure story of having started the Gray Matter Company, yep, and selling it for $5,000. And once again, you can see just an obvious turn there with him and his family and his friends to the project of being the best meth cook, making the most money, becomes its own ambition. And once again, his own personal redemption for...
Yeah, I think that final season where, you know, he wins everything. Like, that's one of the satisfying things about that series is that he does win everything. Like, he loses his family, but he got Gray Matter back. You know, he got control and power over them. He killed off the white supremacists. He got Jesse free, even though, you know, scarred.
Right. And at that moment he dies on a cross, right? I mean, it's just as obvious as it can be, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they did not hide the fact that, oh yeah, he's won. He won. he lost because he died, and, you know, died a meth dealer, but he did win the American story.
Well, you know, and I think it's interesting the interest we have in following that and being sort of volatile, just as with Peaky Blinders. I mean, there's a a morally ambiguous, at best.
At best.
Character, at best, character. But something, you know, relatable, I guess, about wanting to be that person rather than the others. So well, there's something heroic about that.
Yeah, he's got a few of the story isotopes that will let you stay attached to a character. He's smarter than everybody else. He's up and coming. He's always, yeah, he's always growing. He's trying to get somewhere. So some of those things allow you to not completely move him over into the villain category.
And well, when the audiences are trained to cooperate in making the hero the hero, I mean, it's just like romance. It's so formulaic. When they introduce the guy and the girl, you know you're going to want them to get together. And if they, and then they just frustrate that until the right moment, and then they get together. Yeah. So, but that's all. That's you're there doing the script for them. They don't have to do anything to make that happen.
Yeah, there's no pulling the narrative hooks out of
there's no resistance being offered here to this guy being the main guy.
We enjoy those narrative hooks over and over and over again. It's such an interesting software in human beings, that feeling of like, even it was so unsatisfying the end of the fifth season of Peaky Blinders because he didn't win, you know, and they cliffhangered it, but it was a loss, and they usually cliffhanger it or end the season with a victory. And they did this with Tony Soprano. They would just bring on a new horrific psychopath each season, and he would fight them, and they would get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then he would kill them. And you're like, oh, okay, that was satisfying. Yeah. But there's no satisfaction in that fifth season. It's clearly they're playing it like it's half the season that's supposed to come back and finish the next season, but they didn't bill it that way.
I think that's right. Yeah.
So, well, maybe next episode we should just dive into Breaking Bad, you know, and just do an excavation.
Total Breaking Bad fest.
The Breaking Bad rhetorician episode, because there's plenty there.
It's true. We may have done most of it. I don't know, but
No. There's a bunch. I've rewatched that series 4 or 5 times because there's just so much.
It is shockingly addictive. It really is. And I found this time my interest waning once he's made that complete turn. Then it's kind of just reeling it in and, you know, waiting for the big.
Well, I used to do this joke too about Sopranos, and it's also true about Breaking Bad. When I rewatch it, I fast forward all the family scenes. I just want the sex and the murder. Like, I'm here for the sex and murder and the action. I don't want to watch the family drama. Can you imagine how bad those shows would have been if it was just the family drama scenes? Where it's like him talking to Meadow over and over again, or you know, the boy. It's like, these are so boring. But right. Then he goes off, you know, takes her to go to college and kills some hitman.
Right, but it is interesting backstory on Tony that you know, here's a guy just trying to be a dad and, you know, be a normal guy in a suburban home, and you know, so like he goes to work and. But he's also, you know, involved in the psychopathic.
Aren't we all involved?
Just like Walt, you know, and family values is what he's all about. But I just have to be a meth dealer. So
yeah, we're all involved in some kind of psychopathic work. It's just we don't kill people usually.
Yeah, so. I think there are. I've approached these things from another angle too, which is that I think there is a template of values that being exercised in our drama about our relationships with others and workplaces especially. And so I think we could see an evolution through the media dramas where, you know, somewhere in the 80s, it kind of turned from organizational moxie and success to just survival, right? We stick together. Right. Think about it. Kill Street and NYPD Blues. We're just sticking together. The organization, the authority doesn't matter. We're just, you know, it's loyalty to each other. And then that seems to have moved since then into just family. This is the last bastion of value.
Yeah, it's like it's shrinking further and further down. It's like, we're just in a room together. It's like a quiet place. You seen that movie?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, this is all we've got. Don't move too much. Because the evil will hear us.
So the family seems to be the last. And if you think about, you know, what's happened in our lives, certainly in the COVID year here, we are kind of holed up in our compounds.
Very much. That move was perfect presage for all of this. So what do you think? Did we succeed or fail today?
I think success without arrogance and failure with indifference.
You just take that away. You've learned
make,
something.
Make that not the question would be the Zen response.
If you take that away, you've got a little nugget from the podcast that,
that we won't know until somebody tells us. Thank
you. Your money. So right. Cool. Well, super fun. I like talking about failure. I think it's a, and it ties
it's more fun to talk about than it is to experience.
So we'll talk about incompetence in the future. Cause I think I brought this up before we started, like that's the preamble to failure. And
the names of different kinds of failures is fascinating to me. So the inability to compete is an interesting construction. But what do we then start applying that to as a term?
Yeah. There's plenty more here. Maybe we'll come back in the future and do another round on it. Next week, we're going to do Breaking Bad. We'll use that as our foundation, and we'll throw in The Sopranos and some of these others. But if you come back to the next episode, we're going to Breaking Bad it.
Well, maybe Breaking Bad is a metaphor for our sort of existential social moment, because that is like one of the first lines in the text is you're kind of old to be Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
it's Jesse's line.
Right? Yeah, right. Awesome. All right, man. Well, this good episode. I think this is one of our more successful episodes about failure.
Well, it's certainly my most trademarked subject. So
thank you. Yeah, you've got a lot to say on this. So.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. See ya.
Bye.
Thanks again for coming back to the Rhetoric Warriors. Get out there and persuade some people. As always, they need it. And we're giving you the software for it. It's your fault if you're not using it.